This is the Monday, January 11th, 2016 episode of the History Author Show. Visit our iHeartRadio channel or subscribe on iTunes to enjoy a brand new episode every Monday morning.
Oh, New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine. The sawdust is gone from the floor where we harmonize, sweet Adeline. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Dean Karyanis, and this is the History Author Show on iHeartRadio, iTunes, Spreaker, and many other personal audio outlets. You can also tune us in on many new model car stereos, where you can listen to iHeartRadio just like you listen to any other radio, right there on the dashboard. Of course, today, we're not driving a car, but a time machine, and we're going to Charleston our way back to the Manhattan of our theme song, the jazz age of speakeasies and prohibition. While we're there, we'll meet what Scooby-Doo always called a g-g-g-ghost.
Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? We got some work to do now.
Yes, our guest, Lainey Giles, has written our ticket to one of Hollywoodland's very first scandals. Her novel is called The Forgotten Flapper. Her previous novel is Love Lies Bleeding. And next up on her hit parade, she'll bring us The It Girl and Me. As for today's book, The Forgotten Flapper, we get a seat in the balcony of the famed New Amsterdam Theater. It was Broadway's biggest and best when it opened in 1903. Today, it's home to Aladdin, but after the curtain call, when the actors head to their secret night spot and the stagehands are left to lock up, they say Olive Thomas still roams the aisles. You may not know Olive's name today, but if you saw her picture in a lineup, you'd stop and take notice. 100 years ago, Ollie, as she was known, was one of the loveliest girls who ever lit up the Ziegfeld Follies or the silent screen. When Ollie died from mercury poisoning in Paris, the doctors said it was an accident. But her legions of fans suspected foul play. They just couldn't let go of this legend they loved so well. Either way, a true actor knows that the show must go on, and Olive Thomas wasn't about to let a little thing like death get in her way. You can follow today's guest on Twitter at @ForgottenFlapper, that's the digit 4, Gotten Flapper, and visit her website, laineygiles.com. That's LAINIGILES. But before you hit the internet, let's meet our guest and talk The Forgotten Flapper, a novel of Olive Thomas. I'm on the line now with Lainey Giles, who's calling us from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, where you're having a warm spell at the moment. Her book is The Forgotten Flapper, a novel of Olive Thomas. Thank you so much for making the time to talk with the History Author Show today.
Thanks for having me, Dean.
Now, we started out by talking about the fact that Olive, maybe one of the things that so attracts people to her is she was a tragic figure at the time, and she died before the cute little commonly known jazz age things like the Charleston and like our theme song that's from 1925 in the intro. She dies as a young woman really before all this gets going. It's really a life cut short, isn't it, Olive Thomas?
Yeah, it really was, sadly. I took the name of the novel because she actually made a movie called The Flapper that almost no one has heard of. And when you think of flappers, you think of people like Clara Bow or Colleen Moore or even Joan Crawford. And Ollie is basically forgotten, even though she was one of the very first.
I wanted to mention the cover first of The Forgotten Flapper, because when I picked it up, my gut reaction was that that had to be somebody else, that it had to be somebody alive, just because she has such an engaging look about her, her eyes, everything really meet you. It seems like she is somebody that could literally start talking to you, but it really is Olive Thomas there on the cover. She's that photogenic, wasn't she?
She really was. She supposedly had eyes like Liz Taylor's that were that beautiful violet blue, and supposedly her face proportions were perfect. I read some scientific something about there's some ratio about your pupils inside your eyeballs and the dimensions of your pupil to the rest of your eyeball, and supposedly hers were perfect. I can't remember where I read that.
Yeah.
But when my cover designers ran ideas by me, there was a lot of back and forth. And one of the ideas that they had had this lovely woman in it, but it wasn't Olive. And I said, no, I said, I want her on the cover. I wanted to cater this book to my main audience, which is going to be silent and classic film fans. And I wanted to make sure that they knew that's who it was about, because I knew they'd pick it up. You say Olive Thomas around silent film fans and they get all happy. So I know when they were trying to pick a photo of her, I think that one was just in the public domain, and that was how that one got chosen, because I had one or two others that I liked a little better, but public domain, yeah, sure, okay, go with it. And they did such an amazing job. They really did. And then with the titles in the interior of the book, I've got it sort of subdivided, kind of like a movie musical. I've got the overture and act one and the intermission, and they look like silent film titles inside the book. They're just gorgeous. So the book designers, I'll give them a plug.
Well, they deserve it. It really, when you pick it up, there's something that's definitely to it. And I can't imagine using anybody who was a model or what have you that would be more engaging than her picture is. And you can see why people loved her and why they really followed down in this tragic story. I find when somebody that's young and beautiful and has a lot of energy and is so entertaining dies, it's hard for us to accept it. And we sort of decide we're going to attach, there must have been foul play. And when she dies in Paris, of course, that's part of the story that's in your book. I mentioned that you're calling us from Edmonton, but you're originally from Austin. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your writer's journey. It's rarely a straight line, and that doesn't sound like it was a straight line to you. I don't think there's any, I guess there probably is a direct flight maybe from Austin to Edmonton, but tell us how you got from sort of the barbecue and the jazz and all of that of Austin all the way up to Edmonton, Canada.
Plenty of twists and turns for sure. I started writing when I was little. I was a Nancy Drew fan from way back, probably, you know, about 8 years old or so. And so, of course, I had the Nancy Drew ripoff with hand-drawn illustrations when I was about 8, which I still have, believe it or not. In high school, I had a Civil War era novel kind of around Vicksburg during the siege. And then I had a creative writing class in college that was actually about a fictional 1930s actress who was murdered. But I never finished anything. I'd get these great projects in my head and just nothing ever happened with them. And ended up meeting and marrying my husband, who's Canadian. We were one of the first internet relationships. 15 years now, we were one of the test cases in the initial days. And he moved to the States to marry me in 2000. And then around 2009, when the economy started crashing, we said, let's head back north. Let's see how we do up there. We both kind of had some health issues, and we thought, well, at least we'll have health care. That's it in a nutshell. So for the first 8 months or so that we were up here, we were living in a little two-bedroom house with my in-laws north of this tiny hamlet called Wabamun in the middle of my first Alberta winter, and I couldn't work because I'd moved up as the spouse of a Canadian citizen, and I'm a city girl. So I think if you could put, you know, the word for despair in the dictionary, you would have my picture next to it right about then. I was in a really bad place, and writing was what kept me going. My husband would drive into work in the morning, and I'd drop him off, and then I'd go sit at Starbucks for like 4 or 5 hours and just write. And then I'd go get some lunch, and then I'd explore this city that I knew nothing about. I'd go to thrift stores and bookstores and, you know, fall asleep at the Chapters bookstore because I was exhausted.
And better than on the street. You'd freeze, unfortunately.
I actually hit 2 years in Milwaukee to help me get used to the cold.
Oh, okay. This isn't like when I went to visit my wife, who's from Canada. We had the reverse of you, and we predate your internet meeting relationship. So I bet you don't meet many people that say that as far as cross-border North American love stories. And yeah, when they tell you it's cold, you think, oh yeah, I can take it. But gosh, coming from New Jersey, I was not at all prepared for it. But go ahead. I wonder how Olive would have dealt with it. See, that's a segue.
I'm not sure. I finished the first book and then started on this one, and I'm on number 3 now. So when I could finally work, I just get to the point where I'd write for an hour before work and on my lunch break for about an hour, and it seems to be working for me. So Ollie did not like libraries, or at least the Ollie that I sort of got to know while I was sort of being her in the first person. And I kind of pointed out that she wasn't a fan of libraries and books, and she'd rather be dancing or drinking. So I have a feeling she probably would have gone out dancing or drinking to cope with that sort of situation.
Now, we skipped over there how you found out about her first, and then how you decided to sort of put her into this vision that I guess you had from when you were very young. The stories are a little bit connected. So how did you go from meeting her, first learning about her, to deciding you wanted to talk and tell her ghost story here in The Forgotten Flapper?
Anybody who knows about old Hollywood usually will have learned something about it from this awful, awful book called Hollywood Babylon that came out in the 1970s. I found it at the library when I was about 12. And was just fascinated. Like most people, I think, who have read it, it was like every awful, juicy, gory story about Hollywood that's in there. You know, you've got the William Desmond Taylor, and you've got the Fatty Arbuckle, and Alma Rubin's drug addiction, and Clara Bow taking on the USC football team. Every major lie that's ever been perpetrated about Hollywood was put out in that book, usually. I think they're now considering most of the stuff that's in it to be complete and utter bull. But it was sort of what got so many of us into silent cinema and classic cinema, because the stories were just so rich and amazing. And you're like, wow, even without the scandal, these people lived amazing lives. And so that was always in the back of my head. Plus, I had a mom that really liked MGM musicals, and I liked the Marx Brothers and things like that. So I'd always had a head for old Hollywood. But excuse me, in 2009, I read this book called Loving Frank. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a lady named Nancy Horan. It's about the architect Frank Lloyd Wright and his mistress. Her name was Mamah Borthwick Cheney. She was the wife of a client, and he left his wife and children, and she left her husband and children for him. That book just, it was like an anvil over my head. It was just like, that is what I want to do. She just wove her fact and her fiction together so beautifully and so seamlessly. She researched the bejesus out of every fact, and I was like, that's what I want to do now. Who am I going to write about? And at the time, I had also been watching, there's a man named Kevin Brownlow, who did this amazing documentary series about Hollywood, about 1979, 1980, thereabouts. We pretty much owe that man for everything we know about silent classic Hollywood today. He was just this amazing force for learning about it, preserving it, and preserving these stories. He interviewed all of these silent movie stars when they were still alive and captured the stories for us. And because I was watching these amazing people being interviewed, all of a sudden something clicked and I went, silent movie actress. Yeah, that's who I should do. Who should? Olive. And then all of a sudden there it was. It was like, okay, now I got to start finding every possible source that I can find. So that was kind of how it happened.
And that was a challenge for you, too. You mentioned a minute ago there about that book containing so many falsehoods, and I guess exaggerations are usually the norm for books like that. And so you're right in The Forgotten Flapper. You had an interesting note, I guess, at the back of the book where you said literally every book you picked up included conflicting information about her and her husband, Jack Pickford. Did that make it harder or easier for you to sort of let your imagination go? When did you get to that realization that you were never going to be able to have a nailed down fact from a lot of these books?
Yeah, it was. It was really, really hard because, number one, all of the different books had different information. You know, one would say, oh, it was suicide. One would say, oh, he killed her. One would say, no, it was totally an accident. And then there were different news stories and things like that I was finding. They had such a transcontinental relationship where one of them would be working at a studio on the East Coast, one would be working at a studio on the West Coast, and I would write a scene where they were together. And it's like, no, he was on the other coast at that time filming this movie, and so trying to coordinate their schedules was kind of a nightmare. There were times that I just had to say, okay, I'm going to say this. This is kind of a happy medium as to what was going on. And I just sort of had to choose an avenue. Okay, yeah, I'm going to do it this way. And just had to put an author's note in the back because I didn't really have much of an option. And it was really funny because I kept going through these timeline issues, and my husband would be, you know, walking by the bedroom or something one night when I'd be editing, and I'd be like, oh, he's like, timeline? Yes. Because I kept coming up with conflicts, but it seems to have worked itself out. So
now, writing from a ghost point of view, it's interesting that you concentrate on the timeline and try to get your facts right. But of course, then you're writing from a first person ghost point of view there with Olive. She tells the history of this great old theater, the New Amsterdam. And you start with a scene that she tells it almost throughout the theater's entire life, from the Ziegfeld Follies to Disney to the present day. And I thought how much the theater is a character in The Forgotten Flapper, and yet you didn't linger sort of showing off your research and staring at the walls, which is always a danger. You keep her moving pretty fast, but you clearly had an affection for that theater, and so did she, I take it.
Yeah, I just didn't want to stand around, you know, looking at the walls and that sort of thing. I've taken enough writing seminars and classes that I don't want to just say, oh, there's a beautiful box here. There's a gorgeous proscenium over the stage. I wanted it to be in the background, and I wanted it to be there, and I wanted you to get a glimpse at it, but I didn't want to waste a lot of time admiring it. I wanted to make sure that every minute that I spent in the theater was accounted for. I wanted it to be the medium for them dancing and catfighting and that sort of thing. But I tried to make it very vivid in what you did see. I always try to write with the five senses in mind. It's like, okay, what are you going to be hearing in this theater? You know, you're going to be hearing piano tinkling. You're going to be hearing girls doing their tapping or their soft chewing practice. There's going to be girls giggling going down the hall. You know, what are you going to smell? There's going to be sawdust from making sets or paint or that sort of thing. And so I always try to keep that in mind. And frankly, I hate admitting this, because for anybody that hasn't read, I haven't been to the theater, and it has been just this awful guilty point that I have not been to New York, and I need to get there. That's next on my agenda, is to get to New York and just explore it like crazy. But I read so many books and so many articles, and I tried to just completely immerse myself in the place. I hope I did a good job.
Yeah, well, I mentioned to you in one of our early emails when I started reading The Forgotten Flapper, I said, oh, I've been to the New Amsterdam Theater for work once. And so I was able to go behind this set, and I'm looking at it and kind of absorbing the history and walking the corridors. And I'm just assuming you must have spent countless hours there. And that's when you confessed to me that you hadn't gone into it and that you were a little jealous. But you capture all of that. And the important thing is the writing. As you said, there are two important things: not standing around looking at everything, and also being conscious of the five senses. Another thing that aspiring novelists always hear the importance of is the first line. And yours in The Forgotten Flapper, you start off with, quote, "You know, it's really no fun haunting people who refuse to be afraid of you." And it's 15 words. People always like to count the number of words in the first sentence, but they do a lot of heavy lifting there. You're telling us already about Olive's character. You're telling us about that she's dead, obviously, and that she's a ghost. What's the story behind that? Did you go through a lot of drafts? Did you struggle over the first line, or did it come to you pretty early and then you wrote around it?
You know, I honestly don't remember where in the process that particular line came from. I ended up having about 25 or 26 rewrites in total in about 5 years. I had to keep ripping things apart and putting them back together because I would find timeline problems and that sort of thing. But I do know that it wasn't the first line. And I went to the Surrey International Writers Conference back in 2012 in Surrey, British Columbia, which is near Vancouver. And I had a blue pencil consultation with one of our Canadian authors named Susanna Kearsley. And if you haven't gotten into her, do, because she's wonderful. If you are into any of the old sort of Mary Stuart gothic, you know, the Nine Coaches Waiting and the Madam Will You Talk, she writes that sort of stuff. It's really good. She took a look at my first few pages and really liked them. And she was so encouraging because I was at a very low ebb at that point. I don't know how many times I'd queried and gotten the rejections. And I was about ready to chuck it, quite frankly, because I'm like, I can't look at this thing anymore. And she looked at it. Her main takeaway was, well, that's your first line right there. And she took a big pen, circled it, and moved that up to the top. So that's your first line. And I'm like, you're right. Thank you, Susanna, for that.
Yeah, you always need another pair of eyes, I find, for things like that. And then you say, why didn't I see that? But it's really good. You get so much, you get right into it. And it's something that's something of a cliche, I guess, but it's really true how valuable it is. And I'm glad you didn't chuck it because I enjoyed the heck out of The Forgotten Flapper. Again, my guest is Lainey Giles, and the book is The Forgotten Flapper, a novel of Olive Thomas. And by the way, for those of you who haven't yet Googled pictures of Olive, she was voted the most beautiful woman in New York City in 1914. So we know of what we speak here when she say that she was a lovely actress. Your previous book that you mentioned is Love Lies Bleeding, and we can look forward to that new one, The It Girl and Me. You can find today's guest at laineygiles.com or at Forgotten Flapper on Twitter. Kirkus Review calls the book a film buff's dream wrapped in the decadence and glamour of a bygone era. Speaking of that bygone era and film buffs that you mentioned before, one name from the era that people haven't forgotten is Mary Pickford. What was her relationship with Olive Thomas?
She was Olive's sister-in-law, the sister of Olive's husband, Jack Pickford. And there actually is evidence that Mary and the family did not approve of Olive. So when I had to write their scenes together, you know, there are probably going to be some Pickford fans out there that really, really don't like that scene because I made Mary and her mom a bit of nasty towards Olive and vice versa. That scene was a lot of fun to write, kind of the whole cat fight thing. But I mean, you have to think of it this way. That'd be like a modern actor like Channing Tatum or somebody like that taking up with a stripper, basically, because the Ziegfeld girls, they were the celebrities of their day, but there was that stigma of them being showgirls, and they wore very skimpy outfits in a time where, you know, women still had to wear bloomers on the beach, and they couldn't show their ankles, and, you know, the Pickfords, they just didn't think Ollie was good enough for their brother. I mean, they had been poor at one time, too. They were rich now, you know, and her roots were working class, and they were trying to escape from that. So Mary, you know, after Olive was gone, she was trying to say, you know, she was nice, and oh, and she and Jack were so sweet together, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it was bull. It was, you could tell that she was just trying to bruise their Pickford name and that kind of thing. So I'm on Team Ollie.
Well, I think after people read the book, they'll probably at least want to have a tryout on her team.
I hope.
I wanted to mention, as far as one of the reasons why you really fall in love with this character, as you've described her, and this real life person that you look at on the cover of the book, is she does have a lot of funny moments. She has many clever lines. I can see that fight scene being a fun thing to write because she's pretty fast. She's prone to saying things like a gentleman has more hands than an all-night poker game. And none of that seems heavy-handed, so to speak, when you write it. But I wondered how much of that is specific. How much of her voice were you able to pick up on so that you could recreate it?
It's all me.
Yeah.
I went with what I knew about her character. And initially, I was writing this in the third person. And I couldn't figure out why it was so god-awful boring. It was just laying there. And I'm like, what am I doing wrong? And then I read this book. It's a wonderful book called Bobbed Hair and Bathtub Gin by a lady named Marion Mead. And it was about four lady writers from the 20s. It was Dorothy Parker, Edna Ferber, Zelda Fitzgerald, and Edna St. Vincent Millay. And she has kind of goes through all four of them in various parts of the 20s. And the slang and everything in it just hit me. I was like, that's what I need to be doing. That's what I'm missing. I'm writing this as a college-educated 20th century woman, and Ollie needs to be telling her own story here. And then I realized, well, okay, people are also going to be wanting to know about this ghost because that's such a main focus of her story. So I thought, well, duh, have the ghost tell the story. And a lot of people don't like that about the book. They start reading and they're going, I don't want to read about a ghost, but I just made it for, you know, a little bit of the intro. And then she goes into her story and then the ghost kind of takes it up at the end. And I didn't want it to be completely ghosty. I wanted it to be the story, but I wanted her to have this voice. Supposedly she had a mouth like a sailor, you know. There's one line that I really wanted to put in there where some woman was in the hotel lobby and was sitting near her or something. I said, oh, you know, goodness, what a beautiful diamond you have. She goes, oh, this, I got this for, you know, two humps with a Jew in Palm Beach. And I wanted to put that in there, but I wanted her to be fun loving. I didn't want her to be, you know, coarse. And
yeah,
so I was trying to, like, where can I draw this happy medium? Because that was such a great line, but it's like, okay, well, I'll come up with some lines that are just as good. And it's amazing what you can do with a Castle Slang Dictionary and watching a lot of Boardwalk Empire. And I have this wonderful radio station that I listen to in Fort Worth called Radio Dismute that plays a lot of old 20s and 30s music. And so that kind of helped me to put together something. And the more that I polished it, the better that it got. And like Hell's Bells, I had a reviewer saying, I wonder if Hell's Bells was really her favorite saying. It's like, no, of course not. It was something my mom used to say a bunch when I was young. And it seemed like the most kind of 20s flavored curse that I could come up with that would have been lightweight, you know?
Yeah. And that's also part of the heavy lifting and choosing what words to leave out. And I remember taking one writing course and they said, put every word in your novel on trial. And that line there in the hotel would have colored her character, and it would have done heavy lifting maybe in ways you didn't want to. So
exactly.
It's hard to know exactly what to leave off. It's sort of like a haircut. It's what you leave on that matters, my sister-in-law used to say. And so that's sort of the thing. You don't want to make them go too far, especially when you're writing for people 100 years later. Obviously, we have many different sensibilities. That's always a challenge. I think you certainly met it here without making it seem like, as you said, you're a modern woman writing it. You did have previous experience. You wrote your first novel, Love Lies Bleeding. That starts off when a hiker discovers a skeleton from a 1916 murder. So that was your way sort of to get back in time there. Your next book that we mentioned, The It Girl and Me, also to the Jazz Age. Isn't that right? And as you mentioned here, Olive really died before the Jazz Age super took off, things like the Charleston that we associated with. But you're going to visit with Clara Bow, aren't you, in this next novel?
Yes, yes. When I finished with Olive's story, I missed her so much. I was grieving because I couldn't be her anymore. I'd been her for close to 5 years. And I was like, who can I do next? I ought to keep doing this. And I was like, oh, Clara Bow, she's the obvious choice as a flapper, right? And then it was like, okay, as a writer, you always have that decision when you begin working on something new. It's like, okay, what's my viewpoint going to be? Am I going to do this in third person? Is it going to be omniscient narrator? Is it going to be first person? And Clara, for as amazing an actress as she was not all that bright. And I needed to be able to comment on her behavior and what she was doing, you know, somehow, but to be able to express it well enough. And so I thought, why not her secretary? She took Daisy to court in 1931, and it was this huge scandalous trial where Clara accused Daisy of stealing from her when Daisy had actually amassed her a fortune so that she could retire. And this was a huge deal. So that's kind of how I came up with the It Girl and Me. It's from Daisy's perspective.
Okay, well, we have that to look forward to. So we certainly will do that. And I hope people will check out, of course, The Forgotten Flapper. We have reached the time for the curtain call here in the interview. So I want to squeeze in one last question. And it's one that I can rarely ask guests that are writing about people 100 years ago or at any point in history. But since we do have this very real story, I guess you'd say, of Olive's ghost, we don't know if her ghost is real or not, but the story certainly is. It's a great legend here in old New York cinema. Should you be at the New Amsterdam Theater when you finally do get to visit, and it's some late evening and you run into the ghost of Olive Thomas, what would you say to her?
I'd say, Ollie, I hope you like having some attention again, and I hope more people can discover you in your movies. Number one is, I hope I made you proud. I'm hoping her ghost is smiling and that we can share a special moment, because I had so much fun being her for 5 years, and I want her to know how much joy that she gave to me and to so many others. I think that's probably the point I'd want to get across.
Well, I am certainly one of the ones that took joy from your book. Thank you so much for writing The Forgotten Flapper. Lainey Giles, I appreciate you joining me today all the way from Edmonton, Canada. I hope that you continue to enjoy this warm weather, and I very much look forward to your next book.
Thanks, Dean. I appreciate you having me on.
You've been enjoying my interview with Lainey Giles, author of The Forgotten Flapper, a novel of Olive Thomas. Her previous book is Love Lies Bleeding, and we're awaiting The It Girl and Me. As always, you can find the Amazon link to purchase the book at historyauthor.com, and we hope you will click through there, or even bookmark our URL for all your online purchases. Amazon.com gives us a little extra cabbage, jack, rhino, scratch, you know, money every time you do. And even though we get a percentage, it doesn't cost you anything extra. So we really appreciate you giving it a shot. Once again, I'd like to thank Lainey Giles for bringing Olive Thomas back to life and giving us something to watch out for in the New Amsterdam Theater besides the latest show. You could follow Twitter at ForgottenFlapper, again the number 4 there, and visit her website, LaineyGiles.com. And remember, let us know what you think of The Forgotten Flapper and the interview on Twitter at HistoryDean or at Facebook.com/HistoryAuthor. I hope you'll join us next week for another trip into the past here on IR Radio or wherever it is you're listening. And remember, if you do subscribe to us on iTunes, please leave a review. Well, that's it for this week's installment of The History Author Show. So until next Monday morning when we step into the mystery machine, I mean time machine, thanks so much for listening. And happy reading.
We still call it Broadway, but what's in a name? Take it from Georgie, it isn't the same. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guy.